You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this week's episode, which is part of Sci-Fi Comics Month on the show, I'm talking to the creators of the classic Doctor Who comics, which were serialised in the nascent Doctor Who weekly magazine 30 years ago. Later in the show, I'm talking to writer Pat Mills about collaborating with fellow Judge Dredd creator John Wagner on the first 43 of those strips, and also about his forays into writing Doctor Who as radio plays. But first, I'm talking to artist Dave Gibbons about giving the Fourth Doctor, as played on TV by Tom Baker, adventures in print that were even more outlandish and over the top than seen on screen. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, country, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
In 1979, obviously the cultural landscape was quite different. In terms of Doctor Who, probably then as now actually, it was at its most popular. But both of you had been doing 2000 AD for a couple of years. So what drew you to doing a licensed property?
Well, what actually happened was that I was approached by Des Skin, who at that point was, I think, the managing editor of Marvel UK, and they'd acquired the rights to do a Doctor Who magazine with some comic strip in it. And initially he asked me if I wanted to ink the pencils of Paul Neary, who was kind of on staff at the time, and they thought that they would, you know, produce the strip in-house and I would put a professional sheen on it. But that really didn't appeal to me because it was an odd amount of work. It wouldn't have taken me a whole week just to ink a handful of pages. And I proposed to them that I draw the whole thing because I'd got kind of... I wasn't too happy with the scripts I was working on at 2000 AD, and it sounded like an interesting thing to do. And the other thing that I knew was that Pat Mills and John Wagner had at some point prior to that submitted story ideas to the BBC for the Doctor Who TV series without any success, but I knew that they had these stories already worked out. And as I'd never quite been able to get to work with them on 2000 AD, I thought this was the perfect chance to get some really good scripts. So I approached them, and then they had discussions with Des, and pretty quickly we all got signed up and started work.
I mean, I suppose like all things, 2000 AD probably went up and down in quality. Was it just going through a bit of a lull at the time that sort of the three of you were interested in doing other projects?
Well, it was rather more that I'd sort of on 2000 AD, I'd done Harlem Heroes and I'd kind of done Dan Dare. I'd had two goes at doing Dan Dare and it never quite worked out. So I was really, you know, looking for something new. And as far as, you know, visibility was concerned, it seemed to me that Doctor Who was pretty visible, and it also kind of played to my strengths in that it was science fiction and it was humorous as well, and also you know, there was a change of locale every adventure, which again, you know, I knew would keep the whole thing fresh for me.
Well, I mean, I suppose that's one of the appeals of Doctor Who, both as a comic and a show, that other than the central character and the ship he travels in, it can be pretty much any genre, you know, from one story to the next. So when it came to doing the Doctor Who stuff, how much of a collaborative process was it? Did you get any say in the storylines or just purely in sort of the monster design and the ship design?
Well, I mean, Pat and John both work in very different ways. I mean, Pat would have huge discussions on the phone. You know, we'd sort of go over the whole thing and I'd say what I felt like drawing and scenes that I thought I could, you know, make a bit more of. And he would send me clippings of things. magazines and books and send them as reference, and there'd be a lot of toing and froing before the final script arrived, and then it would be a full script, and I'd pretty much draw from that. John, on the other hand, is a much less kind of demonstrative individual. I don't know if you've spoken to them both, but John's scripts tend to be, as I think I described them elsewhere, you know, like a series of exciting telegrams. And he likes to leave a lot up to the artist. He really describes very little. So, again, that was really enjoyable, because although the stories were jointly credited to John and Pat, in fact, they alternated. Pat wrote the first and third ones that they did, and John did the second and fourth. And again, I mean, that gave me a nice variety, you know, from the sort of manic intensity of Pat to the kind of laconic, you know, kind of shorthand approach of John.
And even though it was a different comic, the three of you actually seemed to bring a 2000 AD sensibility to the comic, from both kind of the black humour and the absurd situations.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I think 2000 AD had really, you know, kind of captured lightning in a bottle. It was a wonderful blend of humour and adventure and kind of gross out, you know. And it was always done kind of firmly with tongue-in-cheek. And also, I mean, it was a very British phenomenon. You know, the sense of humour and the sensibilities were very British. And I think it was essential to do... the Doctor in the same way. I think that the Doctor only really works when you have, you know, British creative teams, because it does speak to something sort of quintessentially British, I think.
How was it working on a photographically recognisable character? I mean, did you have to work on Tom Baker's likeness for a while before you felt happy drawing him?
Well, I had to do a sample sheet for Marvel and BBC, and I mean, I essentially just got hold of the most expressive pictures of him that I could find, and, you know, based my rendering on the photo reference. I was also lucky enough to be friendly with an artist called Martin Asbury, who at one point drew Garth and has later become a storyboard artist. He'd had to draw the Doctor at one point. And of course, back in those days, there were no such things as video recorders, which of course would have made everybody's life a lot easier. And Martin had actually taken photographs from the TV while the show was being broadcast. So I had a big kind of random stack of blurry, kind of distorted pictures of Tom Baker there. At a later point, Des and I actually went up to the BBC and raided their photo archive and got some really good stuff there. But actually, Tom Baker was quite easy to draw, because he had, you know, the big nose and the double chin and the big toothy grin and the curly hair. He was really quite easy. The way that I tended to work would be that I would pencil out the whole strip and really just kind of do a kind of sketch of his head. And below a certain size, I would just kind of wing it, you know, maybe glance at a photograph as I kind of drew his head. But then when I got to a size of head where a likeness became critical, I would sometimes arrange it so that I had a very good clear photo that exactly fitted, and I would then either freehand that, or, to be honest, I would most usually put it in an opaque projector, which is a kind of magic lantern, and actually, you know, project it onto the artwork so that I could get a very accurate tracing of it. And then, obviously, I would interpret and ink on top of that. But in fact, you know, I found that if you put in a really good likeness every two or three pages, that, you know, a lot of the other likenesses would be forgiven. In fact, I mean, the real genius at doing that kind of thing was an Italian artist called Alberto Giolitti, who used to draw Star Trek for Gold Key in the States. And he had this wonderful scheme where on any given page he would have, like, one shot of outer space, one shot that was a back view of everybody, one shot that was a silhouette, you know, one various shot, and one good close-up of one of the actors. And, you know, that's the way that I really did it. When, I don't know if you're encompassing Peter Davison in this as well, but when I came to have to draw him, that did give me a problem, because I was actually having to draw an episode with really only about three pictures of him, and three pretty blurry, grainy, high contrast pictures at that. And actually, his agent was very unhappy with the likeness that I did. Although I must say, looking back at it now, I think it's pretty good, all things considered. Yeah. But he again was—he was very cooperative. He let myself and Alan McKenzie, who was by then the editor, actually go to the BBC studio and actually get some really good reference shots. He was very cooperative and pulled faces and span around in a in a chair so we could get the different angles. And that made my job very easy because he was quite a difficult guy to get a likeness of because he was blonde, he had fairly bland, pleasant features. Very, very difficult. You really need somebody who's halfway to a caricature anyway to draw a successful comic book likeness.
Well, it wasn't long after Pete Davidson became the Doctor in both the strip and the show that you moved on. Was it that you thought you'd done all you could with the strip, or the change in Doctor, you thought it was as good a time as any to move on to different projects?
No, it wasn't that. It was that America came calling.
Oh, cool.
while I was working on that, and I was still sporadically doing stuff for 2000 AD at that point, I'd worked on Rogue Trooper while I was doing Doctor Who for Marvel, and co-created him with Joey Finlay Day. But yeah, around the end of sort of 1981, I think it was around the end of then, the editors from DC came over and made myself and some other British artists offers that we couldn't possibly refuse. And so, I left everything as tidy as I could and parted with Marvel UK on very good terms and passed it over to Steve Parkhouse, who had been writing it at that point. And I think the transition went quite smoothly. And I might also mention, talking about working styles, that actually some of the later things that I did working with Steve Moore and with Steve Parkhouse, we actually did kind of Marvel style, where I would only be given a plot and I would draw the whole thing out from a fairly loose plot. And that seemed to actually work quite well. And again, that gave me a little bit more input into it at a point where perhaps my interest was beginning to flag a bit. And it was great to work with the two Steves because I'd known them since my very earliest days in fandom. And in fact, Steve Parkhouse, who's one of the unsung geniuses of British comics, I'd actually learned to do hand lettering by looking over his shoulder and picking his brains about which pens and things to use. So, all things taken together, it was a really very, very good experience for me, both professionally and from a personal point of view, working on Doctor Who.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you moved from Doctor Who to working in America, because those strips that you did for Marvel UK would then be reprinted in American comic book format over there.
Yeah.
So because they've been reprinted many times, twice in the early 80s, again as the Panini reprint volumes recently, and now again as single comics and books by IDW.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, they've had a real longevity compared to many of the other Doctor Who stories.
Yeah.
On latter editions, they then were reprinted in colour. Did you have any involvement in the colouring of the strips?
No, the IDW did ask me if I wanted to be involved and perhaps do new covers, but I thought probably I had been to the well kind of once too often. I mean, I really enjoyed doing the covers for the original Marvel US versions because I was able to look back on the work I'd done a few years earlier and kind of, I think, improve on it and pick out, scenes that I think make good covers. I should also say on the subject of reprints that we have never received any royalties from
really?
Them. Which, of course, obviously, if we had or we'd have received reprint fees, we would have probably done quite well out of it. But there's one thing that I must say. When the Marvel US first reprinted it, they did originally start to pay me a royalty, but when they discovered that, as far as they were concerned, they contractually didn't have to, Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief of Marvel US at the time, and who, one way or another, has got a fairly bad, I wouldn't say a bad reputation, but somebody who's, perhaps thought of less than well in many circles, he actually went out of his way to ensure that although he couldn't pay me a royalty, that he did pay me an exactly equivalent amount under the guise of being art assistants or, you know, something like that. So he actually did play very fairly with me there, which is something that I'd always appreciated. But it's a shame that that we haven't ever got reprint money for it. I mean, the way contracts and things were done back in those days wasn't quite as clear cut as it's done now. I at the moment haven't got the interest in kind of pursuing it. But I suppose you know on a less kind of venal or monetary level, it is very surprising and flattering that after all this time, you know, there does still seem to be interest in the material. I mean, I think the format made it ideal, you know, that they were stories of a length and a size that lend themselves to easy comic book reprinting. And I must say that I think the colouring on the IDW editions is obviously a labour of love. I think, as with a lot of colouring on modern comics, it's perhaps a little over the top, or perhaps it's just that I'm so used to seeing the material in black and white. But anyway, at any rate, the guys at Panini and the guys at IDW, I know, have treated the material with great care and reverence, and I'm, you know, on the whole, I'm very grateful for that.
Ironically, you know, your most famous collaboration, which is being talked about a lot now because of the film and the DVD, is obviously with Alan Moore.
Yeah.
And you both worked on Doctor Who magazine at the same time, but possibly never met, because he did, I think, three backup strips.
Yeah, no, Alan and I had met by that time, and I think we'd possibly even done some sort of future shots together. But, I mean, that was at the time... I mean, I'm a little bit older than Alan, and that was at a time when I was... You know, I'd been working professionally for maybe 5 or 6 years, but he was just beginning, and he was doing things like short stories for 2000 AD and backups for the Marvel comics. But we certainly had met. There used to be a thing back in those days called the Society of Strip Illustration, and we both used to go along to that. And, of course, also Warrior started at a similar kind of time. Well, it started after Des had left Marvel, so we were all, you know, pretty much swimming in the same soup then. Although it would be, as you say, you know, several years before we got together on Watchmen.
I don't think anything we talk about now will make a much difference to Watchmen DVD sales, but I wonder if you might like to I could talk about the graffiti project you're doing next week, which sounds really interesting, on the South Bank.
Admit that I don't know very, very much about it. I've spoken to a guy called Chu, who is the artist on it, and he's run some of his ideas past me, and it sounds absolutely spectacular. And I'm really excited to see what he comes up with. I'm actually going to the convention in San Diego, but I will be back, as it happens, in time to go along to that. So I'm very much looking forward to going along and sort of seeing it firsthand. And certainly, from everything that's been said, I think, you know, again, we've been very blessed that everybody who's had anything to do with the various Watchmen projects is an absolute fan and absolutely committed to it. And I'm sure he's going to come up with something really cool, as I believe you skateboarding youth say.
Indeed.
I'm just reading news reports of a giant squid attack on San Diego. it's in the Guardian. I'll send you the link.
Really? Brilliant.
Yeah, mass protest.
Ah, okay. Well, funnily enough, actually, I'm going to an art opening in Camberwell next week about a travelogue graphic novel about Thai food.
Right.
And they're having a special squid party opening night, so it's all connected.
It is. Oh, yeah, there is nothing that just happens. It all joins up.
Next, you'll hear my interview with Pat Mills about his writing Doctor Who. And before that, here's an extract from Pat's latest audio play, The Scapegoat, which includes Samantha Bond and Paul Rees in the cast, and stars Paul McGann as the Doctor, with Sheridan Smith as his companion Lucy.
Except the TARDIS is where?
It was where that is.
That being the traditional fairground carousel that appeared when our backs were turned.
The TARDIS's chameleon circuit must have accidentally engaged.
Chameleon? You mean that's the TARDIS?
But something must be really wrong. It shouldn't be this conspicuous.
You're telling me? Doctor, that thing's going to bring half the German army down on us if we don't get a move on.
Probably.
Right. So if that's the TARDIS, let's... How do we get in?
Get that, Lieutenant.
Triangulation coming in now, Herr Major. The object appears to have landed in Sector 7.
Montmartre?
It's a maze round there, Herr Major. Place Pigalle, Rue Chaptal, Rue Baroque. The device could have landed in any of them.
And there are no reports of enemy planes crash landing in the district?
Not so far, Herr Major.
No sightings from our own observers?
Apparently not, Herr Major.
Strange. I should have thought an Allied secret aircraft would stand out, even amongst the exotic sights of the Pigalle.
Well, at the risk of making an awkward point to start off with, you've been associated with Doctor Who for 30 years now. which I guess shows the longevity of the show, that it had been around for 13 years when you started working on it. That was through pitches you made to the BBC for the show itself?
I think, yeah. I mean, it's so long ago. Mm. I've got to cast my mind back, but... I think what we did was we thought, well, you know, we can try some of these ideas out, and if they like them, great. And if they don't, you know, they'll make also good comic stories. Yeah. Mm.
Because at that point, to put it into sort of perspective regarding your career, 2000 AD had been around for a couple of years. So I'd like to think that in sci-fi circles in the late 70s, you'd have garnered, you know, a bit of a reputation by then.
Yeah, I think as far as comics were concerned, yes. I think where television is concerned, and it's another animal, and you know, it's a different media. But I think I can't remember their reasons for turning those ideas down.
Mm.
But in fact, I think what happened subsequently was a new idea came up.
But there was still a bit of a gap between the stories that you had in Doctor Who Weekly and you pitching Space Whale again to the BBC as a TV idea.
Yeah, I think it would have come later down the line. But I suppose what it is that, you know, Doctor Who is a great programme, has lots of science fiction, 2000 AD is science fiction. So, you know, it makes sense to submit ideas for it. And, you know, I like the character, I like the programme. So, you know, you try different things from time to time.
You must have actually grown up watching it.
To a lesser extent rather than a greater extent. I suppose I'd been doing other things on a Saturday night or whenever it was, but I certainly was a big fan of Tom Baker and John Pertwee as well. So, yeah, they're both locked into my mind, great doctors.
I wonder if Tom Baker's Doctor in particular appealed to you because he was very much an anarchic figure who was sort of railing against authority throughout his tenure on the show.
Well, I think another reason might be he's a very over-the-top figure.
Mm.
And that, for me, actually made him very easy to write by comparison with, say, doctors before him and doctors after him. I think it was actually quite difficult adjusting to the more straight character of Peter Davison.
Mm.
I think flamboyant characters are always easier to write.
Mm. You know? And looking at those early stories in Doctor Who Weekly, it had been a bit of a gap since there had been Doctor Who comics before, and the kind of strips they'd had in TV comics seemed fairly tame, while the strips that you and John Wagner did in Doctor Who Weekly seem to be very much fitting into your sort of 2000 AD aesthetic.
I think that's true, and I think they were stretching some boundaries, which were perhaps useful later on, in as much as the stories are much longer. I think the plots were of a kind of television standard, and I think, for instance, they were covering some new ground, like... having a black female companion, which, you know, didn't seem that unusual to me in the world of comics, but I think was at that time, you know, fairly unusual perhaps for Doctor Who, I don't know.
Well, it took them another 25 years on TV, so...
I guess, yeah. And also, you know, that was writing in there, which I was very familiar with because I, wrote Grange Hill comics and things.
Right.
So they seemed like a natural thing for me to do. And I suppose having what you might call twist characters, like the Meep, for instance, who looks cute and, you know, really cuddly, and he's being pursued by these two or three really bestial-looking aliens.
Mm.
And in fact, they're the good guys, and the cute-looking furry alien is actually a master criminal. I think that was pretty unusual for its time, and I think perhaps even now it would be quite effective.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. I mean, a strip like Skiers in 2000 AD is sort of Alan Moore's response to E.T. by setting in England and having all our, you know, kind of our preconceptions of contact with Alien. But your story, Star Beast, almost preempts E.T. by saying, oh, look, here's this cute little alien. We couldn't possibly trust him.
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who knows my work knows that generally I'm pretty suspicious of anything that looks overly cute or I like to sort of move the goalposts a bit. Yeah, I think there's this idea that somehow aliens will be quite sort of benign characters, and I wanted to challenge that a bit as well, I think, yes.
Mm. And then conversely, with your first strip, The Iron Legion, I get the feeling that even if you did pitch it to the BBC originally, being able to do it as a comic meant you could do the $100 million version that they could never do on TV.
I know. I think, isn't that great where comics can really do that, where you can have Roman tanks and fantastic robots? And particularly at that time at the BBC, it would have been a bit low rent, wouldn't it? I mean, a bit different today, you know, with the special effects they have now. But, I mean, they're great characters, and the idea of Roman robots, I think, is an awful lot of fun. It almost needs revisiting in some way, doesn't it?
Mm. I guess maybe because you guys were collaborating with Dave Gibbons and also the continuing popularity of Tom Baker as the Doctor, those early strips seem to be the ones that have been reprinted the most over the years. They were reprinted as Marvel US comics. They've just been reprinted again recently by IDW. I mean, do you look on them with any sort of fondness after all this time?
I think so, because, I mean, they were good stories. They were good stories. Dave's artwork was amazing. I mean, he really captured, you know, the character of Tom Baker so well. And yeah, they moved along very nicely. And the other thing was, when we were commissioned to do them, that I think it was probably the first time that they had really given the space and the budget to afford strong writing on the stories.
Yeah.
So I think that's why they stand out so well, because they did have all that energy behind them.
Mm. Mm. You know, you've famously compared 2000 AD to punk in the past. And certainly, I think, you know, the combination of the strong and occasionally shocking writing and Dave's, you know, stark black and white artwork is such a sea change to the way that Doctor Who comics had been done before. That, you know, I'm curious how it went down with readers at the time, because I imagine 2000 AD readers would be very comfortable with it, but maybe Doctor Who fans would actually think, gosh, this is actually quite shocking.
I think it went down well, as far as I know. I mean, I don't remember any specific feedback. We carried on writing Doctor Who for some time, and then their budget got cut, and we couldn't therefore continue. But as far as I know, I think they were happy with it. And I think if there had been any negativity from the readers, I think we would certainly have been told.
Mm.
Yeah, I think we probably were preempting some of the later sort of moves in Doctor Who. But, you know, it's like that in comics. They can sometimes, and especially around that period of time in the 70s, I think they did get a bit stuck in a certain groove, you know?
Mm.
I was never a big fan of those, you know, these kind of television comics. They always struck me as very lightweight, beautiful artwork on occasion, but the stories always struck me as a bit frothy, not about much, really.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting as well, because Doctor Who at the time on TV, even though Tom Baker stayed on for another year, it went through very much a sea change in the storytelling, because Douglas Adams had been the script editor and it was full of a lot of whimsy. And then Chris Bidmead took over and suddenly they introduced a lot of hard science and reduced the jokes. And the kind of Doctor Who stories that you were telling seemed to be more to do with the older era, where you could actually get away with the anarchic humour rather than sort of trying to play it as serious space opera.
Yeah, I think that's true. true. And I think when I submitted the Space Whale story, which was accepted by the BBC, or at least accepted initially, it was my misfortune for it to be right in the middle of, you know, all these sea changes you've described, and then some. There was a lot going on, yeah. And you couldn't really second guess what was going on, because I suppose they recognised that for whatever reason they needed to move on from what Tom Baker was doing into something else. And I think it was probably a tricky time.
Yeah, your Space Whale pitch, as it was first submitted to the BBC, that would have been a late Tom Baker story then.
Yeah. It gives you an idea of just how long these things take. It was. Let me see now. It was submitted to the BBC. And it did feature Tom Baker, so it would have had a certain amount of comedy and humour in it.
Mm.
And if you've only got to look at Iron Legion to get an idea of how that would have played out.
Mm.
Chris Bidmead accepted it, liked it, although he did say, and that's tying in with what you're saying, that he wasn't 100% sure of the sort of technical side, the science side of the story's premise.
Mm.
And then it went forward from there, and of course it was Peter Davidson, so the approach was much straighter, and so it went on, yeah.
Considering that it sort of sat on the desks of various Doctor Who production teams for 2 or 3 years, when it kept on being not commissioned, were you ever tempted to turn that into a comic strip?
Yes and no. I think when eventually it was pulled, I mean, just to give a brief reprise on this, as you say, it was accepted, it was scheduled, it went forward over several seasons, and actually signed off on it. In other words, went to lunch with the script editor, he said, that's it, it's finished, finito, it's all systems go. And then 3 months later, there was a change of mind, change of plan, and the story was out. So obviously, once it hit that point, I did consider using it in some other way. Because it's a very strong story.
Yeah.
You know, over the years, you know, come up from time to time. But it wasn't meant to be. It was clearly waiting for the Lost series, the audio version by Big Finish. So it's finally, if not seeing the light of day, being heard.
Mm. And now it's going to be starring Colin Baker's Doctor.
Yeah, because it actually extended that far. In other words, because it was going on over that period of time, which was several years, in other words, it would be lined up and then it would be pushed back and so on, it went through the Peter Davison era to the very beginning of the Colin Baker era.
Mm.
So it's actually quite legitimate for it to be, for Colin Baker to be the Doctor in this drama, yeah.
Mm. There is a school of thought that you can write a Doctor Who script and leave the Doctor relatively generic because the actor playing him will infuse the character with his personality. But as your script did pass through 3 different Doctors, did you rewrite it as you went along, bearing in mind the personality of the actor playing him?
I think there is a certain amount of truth in that. If you say, for example, say the recent Doctors, or say, for example, Tom Baker and then Colin Baker, but Peter Davison was definitely, it was very definitely a different spin. And it was made very clear to me that they didn't want the kind of comedy dialogue that was associated with Tom Baker. It did come back again with Colin Baker to a certain extent. And I think in a sort of perhaps more modified form, it's still there today, alongside new elements, perhaps. So it was tricky, you know, that process. Because I think for me, and perhaps it was my inexperience as a writer, I don't know, but I found it actually quite tough to write it with the mould as was then indicated for Peter Davison. In other words, my recollection is that any kind of whimsy or anything was discouraged.
Mm.
And then clearly, yeah, you know, as the Doctor goes through another incarnation, comes back as the Colin Baker character, that's much more flamboyant. So then it was almost like, you know, you could almost go back, not exactly to where you started from, but yeah, so there are different nuances. But I think that was a particularly tricky period. I don't know, but I would suspect that in more recent times, the differences are largely down to the actor's interpretation, I would suspect.
Mm. And the other Doctor you've written for, and in fact written dramatic scripts that have been performed, is Paul McGann in recent years.
Yeah.
How did that come about, your first one, Dead London? Did they approach you, or did you approach them?
Well, magazine. So I knew him from that direction, and we talked about it over the years. And because he had a, you know, he knew about the Iron Legion and various other stories, and so it seemed like a good idea to submit something to him, which he liked. That was Dead London, and I enjoyed doing it very much.
Well, you know, and you've written comics over the years that have been set in various historical periods, and certainly Dead London is your smorgasbord of London throughout the ages.
Yeah.
So that must have been quite fun, just thinking, oh, I'm going to use this bit and I'm going to use that bit and see what it's like when they interact.
Yeah, I enjoyed Dead London for all sorts of reasons, and I think not least because it gave me an opportunity to explore historical themes. I do like historical eras, and obviously they are there in Doctor Who, so... you know, this was a good opportunity to explore 17th century London, World War One. You know, these kind of interesting periods in our past.
And then more recently, you've just done The Scapegoat, and that's set in 1940s occupied Paris.
Yeah.
And it's a twist on the story of the Theatre of the Grand Guignol.
That's right.
What is it about the Grand Guignol that sort of appeals to you? I mean, it seems very strange to us now that in the middle of a period where the French were being browbeaten by Nazi occupation, they would want to see violent plays where people were being disemboweled on stage nightly.
Well, my original interest in Grand Guignol was, because I worked for a French publisher, and I sort of came across all this material and got interested and realised that it seems to have been, probably is on some level, an inspiration for a lot of the kind of Hammer-type films. I mean, the posters and everything are so Hammer, it's not true. And I got very interested in the, you know, it just seems like a great theatre. And as far as I'm aware, I think Interview with a Vampire touched on the theatre in a not that obvious a way. So I just thought this was a great setting. I mean, if you think of Phantom of the Opera, not dissimilar, really. You know, something pretty strange going on in a theatre. So I put this to Alan, who had already done a lot of research of his own about the theatre in World War II. For some reason, that his storyline hadn't gone forward, so he said, yeah, I was very welcome to access his research. And so there's all this astonishing thing of Nazis going to watch these bizarre, really sort of House of Hammer horror-type plays. So to go from there to the... some of the story's central premise of an actor who has died on stage 10,000 times, you know, it struck me as a really intriguing idea. There's a lot we could do with it.
The idea of a character who is a scapegoat, who's accepted his fate to die over and over again, I wonder if that kind of reflects the kind of the Stockholm syndrome that must have existed amongst the French people, that they'd accepted their lot and just tried to live with it.
Idea of a scapegoat, because obviously that's what fascism is based upon, or is one of its pillars, is to find someone to blame for all your troubles. But I got very interested in the scapegoat on more sort of microcosmic level. It's the idea that it's certainly played out in my experience that wherever you live, wherever you work, wherever you go to school, there is always someone who is picked upon. In other words, somebody is blamed, in other words, or made a fool of, or whatever. And I think in mythological times, you know, that was actually acknowledged, and the person or the animal was known as the scapegoat. It was kind of ritualized, and I thought that that had a lot of scope for a story, even though it's a little painful to say, I would say a little regrettably, that it is human nature to pick on someone. It is what we do. It's very unfortunate. I wish it was different, but that is how we are, unfortunately.
And I suppose also it works very well within the milieu of Doctor Who, because he's a character who keeps on dying and comes back from the dead and has sort of vaguely messianic tones, while the scapegoat in the story is someone who's sacrificed, you know, for the people's entertainment. So it has almost these kind of, I don't know, New Testament resonances as well.
There are some different subtexts going on there. I mean, even, if you like, the Doctor himself is, as it were, almost driven out from Gallifrey and things like that. So in a certain sense, you might say he's almost a kind of scapegoat, could be viewed that to in the play, because at the end of the day, it's a kind of Phantom of the Opera type environment where there are these rather nasty plays going on stage, and there's a strange bunch of aliens responsible. So, you know, we need to focus on those things too. But it's a lot of fun, and I think also that environment, World War II, Paris, yeah, it's a nice setting.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much, Alex. Right.
The Doctor Who comics that Pat and Dave did together are available in a black and white magazine-sized graphic novel in this country called The Iron Legion, which is published by Panini, or as an American-sized and newly coloured graphic novel published by IDW in the States called Doctor Who Classics Volume 1. The rest of Dave's run on the comic is also collected in the British Panini collections Dragon's Claw and The Tides of Time, with new American reprints to follow. Pat's Paul McGann audio plays Dead London and The Scapegoat are available to buy on CD or as MP3 downloads from www.bigfinish.com, with Dead London turning up on the BBC radio channel Digital BBC 7 from time to time, and the final Colin Baker version of his long gestating story The Space Whale is due to be released on CD in June 2010. The aforementioned Watchmen art project, that's a collaboration between Dave and graffiti artist Chu, will be taking place on Tuesday the 28th of June at the skate park below London South Bank Centre, London SE1, between 2 and 5pm. While we're on the subject of Doctor Who, comic book creator Ollie Smith has had his first Doctor Who pro story, Blue Moon, published online at www.bbc.co.uk/Doctor Who. You'll find the link halfway down on the right-hand side under Exclusive New Adventure. On next week's show, I'm talking to one of Pat Mills' frequent collaborators, Kevin O'Neill, who together with Pat worked on classic strips such as Nemesis the Warlock and the ABC Warriors, not to mention the anarchic cop who kills superheroes, Martial Law. More recently, Kevin co-created The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen with Alan Moore, which a few years ago was turned into a movie that bears little relation to the original comic. For links to all the above, please visit our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.